Thank you, Judge Hawthorne. I'm Anna Manicarella. My attorney registration number is 40834. I represent Mr. Singley. I would like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, approximately three, if I can do that. There are three issues in the opening brief. I am planning on talking about the first two, but of course I'm happy to answer questions about the third one if the court has questions about that. The first two are intertwined, and they both have to do with the fallibility of eyewitness identification. And they both involve Mr. Singley's constitutional right to due process. Everybody agreed in this case, the state and the defense, that it came down to identification. Was Mr. Singley the person who shot Mr. Amaya Cortez in the street that night? Mr. Amaya Cortez was the only percipient witness. So naturally, Mr. Amaya Cortez, any ID by Mr. Amaya Cortez was going to hold a lot of sway with the jury. The first issue has to do with there was an out-of-court identification and a kind of odd in-court identification. The constitutional premise behind it is that some identification procedures are so suggestive and there can be to mistaken identifications that they amount to a denial of due process. The test that we apply in terms of the out-of-court ID, the photo lineup in this case, is in Bernal, which is a Supreme Court case from 2002. And I'll get into the test, but I think it's important to note that the backdrop of Bernal, which is almost 15 years ago now, the court demonstrates a concern about the fact that mistaken eyewitness identification is responsible. They actually discuss a study in that in the case. And they say mistaken identification, eyewitness identification, is responsible for more wrongful convictions than all other causes combined. It is among the least reliable forms of evidence, yet it is one of the most persuasive to juries. And I would note that in the supplemental authority that the state filed and in the special concurrence written by Judge Berger, that reference is made to Sotomayor's dissent in that case, where she talks about the fact that empirical evidence demonstrates that eyewitness ID misidentification is the single greatest cause of wrongful convictions in this country. Jurors place great weight on eyewitness confidence in assessing IDs, but confidence is a poor gauge of accuracy. So that's the backdrop to this. We're very concerned about eyewitness ID because of the fallibility of it. The test in Bernal is this. The first prong is that, the burden is the defendant's, to show that the photo lineup was impermissibly suggestive. If you can get to that, then it becomes the state's burden to show that under the totality of the circumstances, the identification was reliable. As to prong one, the factors are that the court would look at size of the array, manner of presentation by officers, and the details of the photos themselves. Here, the trial court did an unusual thing. It became quite clear in defense counsel's presentation and argument that she was concerned about the fact that the detective who showed Mr. Amaya Cortez the photo lineup had indicated to him that he had actually said to him, well, there were people matching your description that have been arrested on a separate strong-arm robbery. So he didn't say that they were arrested in this case, but he said they matched the description and they had been arrested on a separate strong-arm robbery. So he had forgotten that he said that to him, but he was reminded of it during cross. And he actually said, oh yes, that's in my report, I agree. That is, if that's what's there, that's what I told him.
Excuse me, was the victim given a written statement that said he should not assume that the perpetrator was in custody?
Sure, he was. He was given a written statement, an admonition. It was read to him by someone who was a Spanish interpreter. And there were a number of things in that admonition, but it was a pre-printed form. It was an admonition, yes, don't, and I think it was, this person may or may not be in the lineup. You don't have to think that the guilty person has been captured. You don't need to identify anyone. But I do think that the actual conversation with the detective, who then said to him, "Who, we actually have a person matching your description in custody," in my mind, trumps the pre-printed form that's read to him, where it's actually, you know, about every case. Mr. Amaya Cortez was told in his case that people had been arrested who matched his description.
Do you have any case that actually says that the oral statements trump the written statement?
I don't have a case that says that. I just think that's as a practical consideration, that you have a person being told that it stands to reason that if they've said we have people in custody, they're not going to waste their time by bringing you something that doesn't have anything to do with people who are in custody. Mm-hmm. That would be the assumption.
Ms. Amicarella, how is that prejudicial if, even if you say it was improper, then there are still six people in the photo array?
It's prejudicial because the notion is that you should pick one of those people, that this person is in custody, and you have a 1 in 6 chance. It's not like he's going through a notebook looking at like 50 photos back to back. He's got six people in front of him. The notion is, and I think the expert in this case talked about that, that you would actually try to, you would select someone, you would select the person, and the data is you select the person that looks most like that person. It's not necessarily the person who did that to you, but the pressure is to pick someone, and that you do. That's why it's prejudicial.
Ms. Amicarella, let me follow up on that a little bit. What, if any, impact would the officer's statement that someone was arrested who matches your description mm-hmm. have in this instance, when it's fairly clear that the lineup photos did not match the victim's original description mm-hmm. of the assailant?
Well, I think, again, the pressure is to pick someone, and I think there's a subtle message in that, because I'm glad you brought that up. They didn't match his description. They were black men, and they had thin mustaches, but they were substantially older. None of them had hair. It was not obviously hard. You couldn't tell height or anything like that from the photos, but the subtle message in that was, you might be a little off in your description of these people. The person we think did this is not quite who you're describing. And so the impulse is for the person to go along with, oh, they must know more than I do, so I'm going to pick someone who's, you know, it's obviously not a photo of six Caucasian nuns or something. It's like they're somewhat similar, but there's a subtle pressure in there that this is, you're not quite right about this.
The reason I ask that is I'm having a little bit of an issue here with determining why this lineup meets the first test of Bernal in being suggestive mm-hmm. when all the photographs were similar, of similar looking men, bald, African-American, roughly the same age. Mm-hmm. So what gives that photographic lineup a characterization of being suggestive?
I think, again, the suggestive nature of it is that they're saying, this person is in custody, pick someone. The data says that people look at that and pick someone. They pick whoever's closest. They don't necessarily pick who shot them. They pick the person who they think looks closest to that person. And Bernal even discusses that, you know, they're worried in cases where the recipient witness is actually the victim, that there's some pressure in that form, right? Because the victim is understandably upset. And it also talks about the notion that there's a weapon involved. And that sort of draws focus. But the bottom line being that they feel the need to pick someone. And so they pick the person closest. And they can be absolutely certain about who they're picking, and that may not reflect accurately at all who actually shot them.
I have some of the same concerns Judge Hawthorne has. I mean, the first concern I have is, it looks to me like what happened here when the police formulated the lineup is they basically disregarded the identification made by the witness and then set up the lineup based upon the person that they had in custody.
Yes.
Because the person that they had in custody looked very little like the description that was given by the victim. So where does this, where does the requirement, if there is one, that the lineup match the description given by the witness, where does that fit into this?
I think, again, we're talking about something that creates this sort of subtle coercive pressure on someone that they, the police are the police. They've been investigating. They know more than you do. And the notion is, well, you're not quite right about this, but you should pick someone. We've got someone in custody. And the so, I mean, I just keep coming back to the same thing, but I think it's true that there's this pressure to pick someone, and you pick the person who looks closest. And that is what you go with. That may or may not be accurate, but that's what you go with. I mean, if it were radically different, they wouldn't pick someone. But they do, because that's there's the pressure to do so.
Well, it was pretty radically different. I mean, the people in that lineup just don't look anything
like 19 to 20 year old men.
Yes.
Right.
With an afro.
Right. They don't. I mean, but they are black men and they do have mustaches. I mean, it's not wildly off the mark, but it is off the mark. I agree. But Mr. Amaya Cortez, had, I think, an incentive. He was the description was he was very upset. He was helping. He was under some pressure to help, and so he did do that. I mean, he wanted to. I think the notion was that he wanted to identify someone, and he did. And that happened to be he happened to be focusing on the person in front of him, not necessarily, as opposed to the person that was sort of more peripherally on the side. So I guess my answer, and I'm running out of time, but I keep coming back to the same thing, which is that, you know, there is, the police know more than you do. They're putting this thing in front of you. They're saying, well, somebody's in custody, and you're looking at this, you're going to pick one. And
it's either now or during your rebuttal, can you address briefly the significance of the expert testimony that the trial court did admit in this case regarding false IDs?
Absolutely, I can. And I just want to say that I'm happy also to, because we're not going to get to the second prong of the Bernal test or the in-court identification. I mean, I just want to note that the in-court identification was very strange in that Mr. Amaya Cortez couldn't identify Mr. Singley twice in the courtroom, even though everybody else could, and then was shown a single photo of him having been arrested that night at a separate location where he basically, he agreed, he looked like his hands were in cuffs and he was near a police car. And then I guess in rebuttal, I will also address the second, because I know an important consideration and the second issue is the Colorado Supreme Court precedent. Basically, that's the Thetis Roberts holding saying we can't do anything about giving this kind of instruction when there's a general credibility instruction. And I have an answer for that. But I think I'm going to hold my time for rebuttal, and I'll talk to you again.
May it please the court, my name is Jacob Loughran, registration number 40904, and I represent the FLE, the people of the state of Colorado. The people respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment of conviction because the out-of-court identification was properly admitted, the in-court identification was not improper, and the district court properly rejected the eyewitness reliability instructions. Addressing first the out-of-court identification, as defense counsel outlined, Bernal test governs this issue. It has for approximately 13 years, and it has a two-part inquiry under that test. The first step, the court must determine whether the photo array was impermissibly suggested, and that is the defendant's burden to prove. In this case, the defendant did not meet that burden.
Mr. Lofgren, let me ask you a question. Sorry for interrupting you so soon, but you're talking about Bernal's first factor being that the photo array be shown impermissibly suggestive. Does the impermissibly suggestive phrase apply only to the photo array, or does it apply to the process around the introduction and presentation of the photo array also?
I think under Bernal it's both. Certainly the process is a step to be considered in determining whether the way it was presented to the victim was somehow impermissibly suggestive. In this case, it wasn't. The defendant kind of hangs his hat on the fact that the detective might have said at some point, we arrested someone on an unrelated crime nearby who sort of matches the description he gave. That's what the record actually bears out in this case, is that that is at most what occurred. The detective never said, I told him we arrested someone. And in fact, didn't even come anywhere near saying that until he was cross-examined repeatedly on the topic and kind of badgered into saying, okay, well, maybe I did say something so much of that at some point.
Mr. Lofgren, this case is different from most of the photo lineup cases with which we deal, where the question is whether the six pictures or more than six pictures have people of similar age, appearance, etc. In this case, the question is more related to the language in Bernal that says that the photo array should have pictures that match the description given by the witness. And do you agree that that wasn't done here?
I wouldn't say that they don't match at all. They're certainly not 100% accurate to the suspect's description, but I don't think the thrust of Bernal overall actually requires that all of the pictures in the array specifically match the suspect's description, or the victim's description of the suspect.
So my follow-up question is, are you aware of any reported case that has addressed this specific language in Bernal about whether the photos match the description given by the witness?
I'm not aware of any case that addresses that specific language. To the same point, I'm not aware of any case that says that the pictures have to match 100% the suspect's description. Instead, what we get from Bernal and his progeny is that all of the pictures within the lineup have to match each other, at least be similar enough to each other that the defendant doesn't somehow stand out from the other pictures.
What is the relationship between the requirement, if it is a requirement, that the pictures match the victim's or the witness's description and the reliability of the ID? I'm trying to figure out what exactly, if the court said what it meant in Bernal, what it was trying to accomplish by saying that.
I think Bernal wasn't addressing kind of the underlying problem that the defendant identifies in this case, which is none of these pictures are similar to the description the suspect or the witness gave. But all of the pictures in the array are similar to each other. And the witness was specifically informed, you do not have to pick anyone from this array. It was slid to him face down on the table with the admonition being provided to him and read to him that he didn't have to pick anyone. And I think fundamentally important to remember here is, and it kind of defeats the notion defense counsel was talking about, is that the victim in this case was given two photo arrays. The first one was the array in which he selected the defendant. And the second array, he looked at it for about a minute and a half before he said, I don't recognize anyone in this array. Suggesting that he took that admonition very seriously. It wasn't something he ignored in this case when he picked the defendant out of the first array. I think.
But if the witness's description that he gave to the police was accurate, wouldn't you have expected him to identify no one in the photo array?
Assuming that he actually believed that to be the description of the suspect. It very well may be possible that once he was presented with that array, he realized, wow, my description wasn't exactly on point. It's actually this man who attacked me, which is exactly what happened here. When he was given the array showing six similar photographs with similar facial features, similar facial hair, similar facial expressions. He said, this is the guy that attacked me. The fact that that differed from his description doesn't change the power and weight that comes with that selection.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Lofgren. When we have a situation as we do here, where the photo array itself does not appear to be strikingly different as each one of the photos are compared to each other, and we have language from Bernal that says the principal question is whether the picture of the accused, which matches descriptions given by the witness, so stood out from all of the other photographs. Does the situation here per se make the process impermissibly suggestive when the six photos don't jive with the victim's original description?
I think Bernal's concern would have been, had this array included a picture that 100% was dead on accurate to the witness's description. In other words, if there was one young African-American male with an afro and facial hair, and five other pictures of 50-year-old African-American males with no facial hair and no hair, that would be Bernal's concern, that one picture that was similar to the description given by the witness so stood out from the other pictures that the witness had no other option other than to pick that picture because it was the only thing that matched his description. In this case, none of the pictures, in theory, matched the suspect's description, or the witness's description. Mm-hmm. Because none of them matched his description, he was free to say it's this one or that one or none of them at all. And he was given an admonition that gave him the ability to say none. Having been given that admonition, he still selected someone from one of the lineups. But he did not select from the second lineup, suggesting he took that admonition very seriously and only selected when he picked the person who had actually shot him. Shifting gears to the in-court identification, because the court raised some questions about that during defense counsel's argument. In this case, it was, I agree, a bit of a bizarre situation. The prosecution asked the victim twice when he was testifying to identify the defendant in the courtroom. He couldn't do it. On redirect examination, the prosecution approached the victim, handed him a photograph of the defendant after he was arrested, standing next to a cop car in handcuffs, and said, can you recognize the person in this picture? The victim immediately said, that is the person that shot him.
Did they look differently? Did the defendant look different at the trial as compared to how he appeared in the photo?
Yes, the police officer testified at trial that between the time he was arrested and the time he appeared at trial, there had been substantial changes in the defendant's appearance. Namely, he had gained a substantial amount of weight and he had more facial hair than he had had at the time of his arrest. This was the prosecution's questions to the officer in order to explain why the victim might not have been able to pick the defendant in the courtroom out as the person who had shot him. So I believe that divergence in testimony, the reason the victim couldn't pick him out in the courtroom, was explained quite easily by the police officer's testimony. In any event, even if the procedure that was used here was impermissibly suggestive and that it was a one-on-one show-up, there was still not a substantial likelihood of misidentification in this case. Because at the time of the crime occurring, the victim had ample opportunity to view the person who shot him, and in fact said he got a very good look at the shooter, that he had a high degree of attention focused on the person who was pointing the gun at him, and that it took him 45 seconds, that when he was presented with the photograph of the defendant, he immediately recognized it as the person that shot him.
But don't we have to take into account that his identification was totally different than that? Doesn't that factor into the mix in terms of the reliability of him in 45 seconds saying, yeah, oh, that's him, when previously he told the police it appeared to be someone entirely different?
Thanks. Can you rephrase your question?
Yeah, well, why don't you just go on?
Okay.
Just go on.
The next issue the defense counsel raises is the eyewitness reliability instructions. And as she identifies in this case, there's binding Supreme Court precedent on point. It says these types of instructions are not required. The district court is not required to give these types of instructions. This court cannot overrule the Supreme Court precedent on that topic. And while there is persuasive authority, I acknowledge, coming out from other states and various federal circuits, that perhaps these instructions may be appropriate in the future, that's a question for the Supreme Court. as Judge Berger recognized in his concurrence in Theus Roberts. In addition, if we look at the Perry versus New Hampshire decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, it lists a number of ways that a defendant's rights can be protected. One of them is the eyewitness reliability instruction, but there are four others that were at play in this case. The right to confront eyewitnesses, the defendant had that in this case. He thoroughly cross-examined the victim, asked a number of questions that poked holes in his identification, both out of court and in court. And in fact, when it came to the in-court identification, the defendant used that as an opportunity to thoroughly cross-examine the victim about the differences between the photograph that was presented to him and his description that he gave to the officers. So in that sense, the defendant's right to confront the eyewitness was thoroughly protected here, and he, in fact, had an abundant opportunity to do so. Moreover, his attorney thoroughly and fully, in opening statement, through all of the cross-examinations and in closing statement, pointed out the concerns about eyewitness reliability, and was able to do so effectively. And the court also gave the general credibility instructions, the general expert witness instruction, and the general burden of proof instruction. As the Colorado Supreme Court has held, those three instructions, and particularly the general credibility instruction, were enough as the public law currently stands. If there are no questions about any of the issues, I would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Ms. Amicarella, you have about 1 minute, 12 seconds.
1 minute, 12, I'll go fast. The whole premise behind this, the Bernal is about, it's concerned with the fallibility of eyewitness identification. It's concerned about reliability. It has a due process concern. So I think when we're talking about the fact that none of these photos matched his description, there is a cue in that. There is something suggestive about that in terms of putting it in front of this person and saying, maybe you should look at this. There's something suggestive in that process of I'm the cop, I know more than you do, or the policeman, I know more than you do. Here, look at this. That the Bernal is concerned with reliability. And I think your question, Judge Berger, is that this shouldn't even go to the jury. I mean, the notion is that if it is so unreliable and it is, you know, an impermissible ID, then it's something that shouldn't even go to the jury. That's the issue, is that it's not an issue, that it's not something that juries should even be considering or hearing, because we understand that juries are very swayed by this kind of evidence. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Is it okay if I just wrap up?
Sure.
And so I wanted to address your question about the expert witness. And it's true that there was an expert witness here, but the expert witness was the defense's witness, and she did lay out a number of things that they could consider. But the jury was also instructed, hey, this is an expert witness, you can take it or leave it, you can weigh it like any other evidence. And she was representing the defense. The defense brought her out. That's not the same as an instruction from the court saying, we are so concerned about this kind of thing that we are going to instruct you as to how to look at it. And just in terms of issue two, I'll draw the expert witness into that, that the Supreme Court precedent is sort of two competing concerns. One is the theory of the case, right? The defendant's theory of the case. The other is this notion that general credibility covers it all. The general credibility instruction is built on a faulty premise. Because now we know that credibility is not the issue. Reliability is the issue. And if you have reliability as your issue, and that's your theory of the case, the general credibility instruction does not cover that. And so the notion would be due process would say you give the instruction that covers that. And I appreciate the time today and the extra time, and we would ask that you reverse Mr. Singley's convictions.
Thank you, Ms. Amicarella. And Mr. Loughran, we gave Ms. Amicarella about a minute and a half extra time there. Do you have anything that you want to say in response to her comments there?
Just briefly address that last point.
Okay.
As to the question about the difference the expert's testimony made in this case, there are a significant number of cases from other states that talk about the importance of expert testimony as it relates to the reliability of eyewitness identification testimony. In this case, the jury heard a significant amount of testimony from that expert about potential issues that can arise with eyewitness identification testimony. The jury heard it, they were able to comprehend it. It took approximately a morning's worth of trial. So the jury heard that evidence and the eyewitness identification instructions were not necessary for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lofgren, and thank you both for your excellent arguments. The arguments will be very helpful to the court in arriving at an opinion and a decision in this case. The matter will now stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much, counsel.